The next case for oral argument is Gaines Motor Lines v. Klausner Furniture Industries. Mr. Mosley.
Hey, police court.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Rob Mosley. Pleased to be here before you today representing seven motor carriers from the Carolinas and Georgia. The case involves numerous aspects of motor carrier and transportation law, and the parties in this case, the shipper is Klausner Furniture. Shipper has a load, they need to place it. And so prior to August of 2007, they actually had a shipping department. At that point in the late summer, early fall of 2007, they decided to outsource their shipping department. And so they took Doyle Vaughn, who had been an employee of Klausner Furniture, and he became an employee of Salem Logistics. They gave notice to the motor carriers that they were currently doing business with that they would no longer deal directly with Klausner Furniture, but instead they would be working with Salem, and in fact working with Doyle Vaughn, who's sitting at the same desk, at the same phone, and doing the same job. So this notice went out. The important thing about this notice is that it said the bills will go to Klausner, care of Salem. It didn't say they're going to go to Salem without any recourse to Klausner. So that I think that language is key. So Salem started arranging for loads to be shipped, but there was no contract. A lot of times in this situation, normally in this situation, the broker
your position, you think you win based on language where? Not in the bill of lading? You don't think you win on the bill of lading?
Well, the document that went out was a letter.
No, I didn't ask you that. I said, you think you win this case based on what language and what document?
Okay, we think we win the case on the bill of lading.
Okay.
However, the magistrate...
In other words, just on language in the bill of lading, there's a bill of lading. If we looked at that language, do you think you win under that language?
Well, Salem is nowhere listed on the bill of lading.
I didn't ask you that. So, you know, I just ended my question. I said, do you think you win based on language in the bill of lading?
Absolutely.
And what language do you think means you win that I can find in the bill of lading?
The box marked prepaid.
All right. Do you think that language is inconsistent with the language above in the main text, I'm calling it the main text, which says, if this shipment is to be delivered to the consignee, I take that as to the purchaser of the product, correct?
Right, at destination.
Right, without recourse on the consignor, which is Klausner, right?
That's correct.
The consignor shall sign the following statement. And that statement, the carrier, the following statement, which is the critical statement, according to that sentence I just read, the carrier shall not make any delivery of this shipment without payment or freight and all other lawful charges. Klausner Furniture signed it. So why doesn't that indicate that Klausner is not responsible?
Absolutely not.
Why, well, that's exactly what it says, isn't it?
Because prepaid says that they have already made.
No, it does not say that. It just says somebody has been prepaid. It doesn't say they've been prepaid.
Your Honor, I think that's where the magistrate got off and made a mistake. The magistrate...
The prepaid doesn't say that the consignor has been prepaid, does it?
The prepaid means the shipper is responsible for paying the freight. That is what prepaid means. There is no other definition in any case that's cited in the briefs.
Well, I'm just looking at the language.
Well,
the language says it's been prepaid. It didn't say it's been prepaid to the consignor.
Yes, Your Honor.
You said there's some law that forces us to read it that way?
Absolutely. Prepaid is a term of art. It is used in the industry, has been used in the industry for 100 years. That means the shipper pays the freight.
Wait a minute now. If it's prepaid, can it be prepaid to a third party and the shipper knows that the third party has been prepaid? Is that possible?
Could
it be a scenario that has been prepaid and everybody knows that it's been prepaid to the shipping agent? I don't know what the terminology, but to a third party. Couldn't that be the case?
Well, and again, you know, prepaid, it's not like a prepaid cell phone where you go to the corner store.
But I know that. You're not answering my question.
Okay.
I said, could it be the scenario that you have a consignor and you have the consignee and you have a shipper, but the consignor is working through a shipping, I'm using the term shipping agent, a third party, like Salem.
A broker. Okay.
A broker.
Yes, Your Honor.
Couldn't it be that everybody knew that the third party was prepaid? Well, the broker was prepaid? Is that not possible?
Well, but Your Honor, you just said it with your own words, is that third party would have been the box.
I just
check.
Said that, but Salem, whoever, that's the third party I'm calling. What? Could that not be understood that it had been prepaid to that person?
No, rather, Your Honor.
Why couldn't it be?
That is just not what prepaid means.
I didn't ask you that. I said in the scenario, couldn't it? You mean that's just factually impossible to apply?
Well, it's prepaid means that the shipper pays the freight. Now, it may mean that they have actually prepaid, but more likely it means the shipper is responsible for the freight under the credit regulations. And so prepaid means
you
shipper.
You say by operation of law, the word prepaid there is, as a matter of law, inconsistent with the consignor signing off responsibility by that statement.
Absolutely.
Could I ask a preliminary sort of question? What specific provision or provisions of the Motor Carrier Act do you rely on to establish jurisdiction?
Certainly, I'd be happy to address that. There are a couple of things that we've got to deal with when it comes to jurisdiction here. And when we got out of deregulation, and it's been a slow process, but as we walked away from having a regulated industry, brokers like this developed because they weren't really out there.
Are you en route to giving me a statutory site?
Well, I'll give you a couple. 14705 is the statute that provides the statute of limitations for a collection case of freight charges. And so
you're not helping me yet.
Okay. Well, you also have 13706, which is a statute that governs collection of freight payments by dealing with consignees. So if we were to try to collect from Klossner's customers here, 13706 would govern.
But that's because even under deregulation, there remain federally regulated shippers of household goods, for example.
Isn't that correct?
Isn't that correct? And
they still file tariffs for household goods.
Exactly, and that leads to my question. I mean, there is case law that specifically holds, and I am looking for. There is no federal question where a shipper has not alleged that it's seeking amounts due under a federally filed tariff. Because this act, the claim simply arises under a contract for motor services. Because the action, therefore, does not arise under any act of Congress, the court lacks jurisdiction.
Your Honor, I would think that by virtue of 14705 and the fact that the federal legislature, the Congress, has set the statute of limitations for when this particular claim that's before the court today has to be brought, that Congress has said we are going to continue to be involved in the collection of freight charges. We still have
four entities that file tariffs.
Your Honor, the statute is not limited to that. The statute is...
The statute doesn't specify, but in answer to my question, that's what you're relying on, 1705.
That 14705 would be one. You know, the Surface Transportation Board is still hearing questions without regard to household goods carriers.
Is that in the record? Is that in the record?
Well, Your Honor, that's the statute. I mean,
I'm asking you, is the fact that the National Safety Transportation Board is still holding hearings without regard to the status of the carrier, is that in the record?
The Surface Transportation Board is I don't know that that's in the record or not.
And that, so I would, if you could just stay within the context of the record, I'd appreciate it. And
certainly.
I think I understand your answer that 705 is the linchpin.
That is, and plus.
And how would we know that based on your complaint?
Well, 13706 was in the complaint. You know, for what it's worth, one of the parties does meet diversity jurisdiction, given the amount of controversy and the facts that they are in different states.
But it's not. But is it a diversity case?
Well, it's not filed as a diversity case. But one of the parties would meet diversity requirements.
Well, how does 1376 help you if the this isn't a suit against the consignee?
Your Honor, in the complaint, you're never sure which way it's going to develop, but 13706 was pled in the event that there had to be some sort of
right. But under the facts of this case, how does that help you?
With the present parties, I don't know that it would be applicable. But it does give you the fact that Congress continues to be involved in this. We still have the regs 49 CFR 377. And 378, 377 dealing with collection of freight charges, 378 dealing with overcharge and undercharge claims, and how those claims are handled by motor carriers, regardless of whether they have filed tariffs or not. So,
to what extent are you relying on 14101? Are you relying at all on that?
Well, 14101 is more general, and I believe that it sets the framework for dealing with all carriers and not just the ones that continue to file tariffs like household goods tariff.
So I'm going back to 705, and I believe you also cited 706.
13706.
13706, right.
14705, 13706.
705 establishes a federal statute of limitations. Does the existence of a federal statute of limitations transform a claim into a federal question?
I believe, Your Honor. I believe it does, Your Honor.
And your authority for that? I thought it simply meant that when you establish a federal claim, it has to be brought within the applicable period.
Well, the 18-month statute of limitations for filing suit on collection of freight charges is a statute that we believe confers federal jurisdiction.
I understand, but I asked two questions. One, does the creation of a federal statute of limitations automatically mean that there is a federal question? And two, well, why doesn't it simply mean that where there is a federal claim, why is it not an after-the-fact determination that where there is a federal claim, it has to be brought within that period, not a substantive determination?
Okay. To answer the first question, yes, we do believe it establishes the claim.
And your authority for that?
Is the statute itself indicates a congressional intent
to have a federal statute of limitations where there is a federal claim. It doesn't speak to when the claim is a federal claim.
Well, and
706 addresses liability for payment if transportation is provided by a motor carrier under this part, which is Chapter 37, which includes circumstances where there is a federally filed tariff, where it's still required that a federal tariff be filed.
There is intent elsewhere in the regulations and in the statutes that the filing of a tariff is not the linchpin of federal regulation. In fact, 14501 has the preemption issue that says no state will have any law to do with interstate transportation. And so it is all federal. It is all federal, whether it's statutory or common law.
It can't be all federal in the wake of deregulation. It can't be all federal.
Well, 14501C says that no state will have any effect on routes, price, and service of a motor carrier or a broker, for that matter, and so the federal law necessarily must apply to this dispute.
Well, then, what was the purpose of deregulation, and what's the point of the distinction with respect to carriers of household goods?
Well, household goods, the government felt like the FMCSA continues to regulate household goods. And the reason for that is because of the potential for consumer issues with household goods. But because commercial entities are primarily involved in the rest of transportation, they have withdrawn from the economic aspects of trucking while still staying into the safety issues of trucking. And so, but that F4A preemption in 14501C indicates that the federal government still must have absolute control over interstate transportation.
You saved some time. Thank you very much. I think your red light came on. It kind of flickered and went off, but I thought I saw that it did. Okay, you saved some time. Mr. Dean?
Your podium is too far from your table. May it please the court, my name is James Dean, and I represent Klausner Furniture Industries, Incorporated. This case is a simple breach of contract action, and resolving the case only requires looking to the intent of the parties and not resolving any issue of federal law. I'd like to start off by addressing some of the questions that were raised.
So your client won below, but your client didn't think that we ought to let it keep the victory.
Unfortunately, that's the case. Okay. And, Your Honor, it's sort of the concept of mutually assured destruction, I think, comes into play. If you can't preserve a victory, what's the point of having the victory? If we were to prevail here on the merits, given the posture of what we believe the statute of limitations is, that victory would not be secure, because statute of limitations can be challenged even after a court of appeals has ruled on it on a case.
Well, I thought, too, you might say sometimes there are obligations above that. You have an obligation to the court and the law to express what you think the law is, even if it hurts you some.
But
the
same I think that's what you meant.
Same result.
Same result.
Well, and
Judge Duncan said that's how she translated what you said.
I agree with the learned Judge Duncan.
Okay.
There is no basis, though, in this case for federal subject matter jurisdiction under federal question doctrine, because the case doesn't arise under any federal statute. In particular, some of the ones that were named in Mr. Mosley's argument were federal statute of limitations. And as Judge Duncan pointed out, the federal statute of limitations doesn't necessarily mean that a federal cause of action exists. It means that there is a federal statute of limitations for those cases that fall within federal jurisdiction. There is still federal jurisdiction over cases that involve a federal filed rate tariff. Because a filed rate tariff has the force and effect of federal law, any case that's brought under one of those tariffs necessarily arises under federal law.
You know, a lot of cases that you see is district courts throughout the country saying there is no jurisdiction on a lot of these cases. Did this one just slip through, do you think? Do you think this just slipped through the lower court?
I don't know. It was raised. I would say that it wasn't argued below because I don't think it was as apparent to Klausner. Facts came up after this order were entered. And because in the complaint, the subject matter jurisdiction basis raised was 13706, but as was indicated earlier, that really didn't come into play in the litigation because 13706 sets out the liability of a consignee, not the liability of a shipper. No consignees are involved in this case.
Right.
And so I think there was a sort of, I would concede that there was a lack of recognition of the issue that was brought
to
light.
Maybe you say maybe a wait and see sort of, depending on how the case unfolded.
Perhaps, I just think that perhaps because it wasn't challenged before the magistrate judge, that it wasn't brought to his attention in a way that made him look at it more deeply. And certainly neither of the parties were looking at it as deeply at that point. One of the other points that was raised in the argument is that the regulations, because there are regulations that deal with credit and investigation of claims, that somehow that creates federal jurisdiction. And the regulations that were cited were in Section 49 of the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 377. And I wanted to point out that those regulations don't actually apply to this type of shipping on their face. So if you look at Part 377, it's separated into two chapters, Part A and Part B. The first chapter begins with 377-101. That first statute says applicability, and it states that the only those regulations are only applicable to cases or to cases that are brought pursuant shipping that's done pursuant to a filed rate tariff. It specifically references 49 U.S.C. 13702, and that's the specific statute that we're talking about that refers to the two categories of trade that still require a federally filed tariff. If you move on to the second part of Part 377, which would be Chapter B, which talks about credit regulations, again, the first statute is 377.201 scope. Part B exceptions says that the regulations don't apply to contract carriers.
Let me shift gears on you. I understand, and I think the panel understands your argument on jurisdiction, but let's talk about the merits for just a minute. Why would we affirm on the merits of this case? What's your argument on the merits of the case?
Well, because the intent of the parties, which controls contract interpretation, clearly indicated that only Salem was intended to be liable.
How do we know that? Based on what document? Same questions I ask of the other side. What document or documents do you look to, and what language do you look to establish that?
Well, the Bill of
Lading. By the way, if you have trouble finding those specifically for whatever reason, just tell me generally.
Sure. Okay. The Bill of Lading is part. And then what the court needs to keep in mind, as the district court did, is that the Bill of Lading was only part of the total agreement between Klausner, Salem, and the carriers that provided for the shipment of Klausner's goods. There was also a confirmation of verbal rate agreement between Salem and the carriers, and there was a pickup and delivery schedule between Salem and the carriers.
What about the absence of a third-party designation? I mean, the Bill of Lading, which was drafted by Klausner, specifically contains a blank for third-party, and yet it wasn't checked. Isn't that the strongest evidence that this was not a third-party situation?
I don't think so, and for two reasons, Your Honor. One is that there isn't actually any evidence in the record about what third party means. And so we could presume or speculate about its meaning, but there isn't any evidence
But as it's set out in the Bill of Lading, it does suggest who's going to be paying, because the first entry there in that lower right-hand corner says prepaid, and that's marked. And the one next to it is not marked, and it says collect. And then the one next to it, also not marked, says third party. So the linear setting out of three different categories of types of payment suggests that what you're talking about is, what kind of payment is this? And it's prepaid according to what the party said on the form designed by Klausner.
I agree with what you're saying, but I think that Klausner used the term prepaid not as a designation of who will pay, but as a designation of who won't pay. That section of the Bill of Lading was used by Klausner as a limitation on liability, and I disagree with Mr. Mosley.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off, Mr. No. Dean. Please go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out that Mr. Mosley said that there was not a case that disagreed with his definition of prepaid, that is, that prepaid means the shipper will pay. Actually, the Ninth Circuit case of Oak Harbor says clearly that prepaid, if signed on the Bill of Lading, releases the consignee from liability. That's exactly how Klausner stated it in what the intent was of Klausner in filling out the prepaid designation. And another thing to point out is that because Klausner was using that to limit the liability of the consignee, checking the additional box of third party would not have actually accomplished that purpose, because if you look in Oak Harbor again, now in Oak Harbor is slightly confusing because the shipper was also the consignee, and he was ultimately liable for payment because it was Sears. Sears did not fill out the non-recourse clause for shipments that were outbound, and it did not check the prepaid clause for inbound shipments.
Well, what about our Hawkspear case? How does that figure into the analysis?
Well, I think that Hawkspear certainly stands for the general proposition that absent a release from liability, the consignor is liable for payment. That's certainly the rule, but in Hawkspear, the court noted that no release had been obtained. And here you have a non-recourse clause that is checked, and the Supreme Court has said that the obvious purpose of a non-recourse clause is to insulate the shipper from liability. I mean, by signing the non-recourse clause, Klausner clearly indicated, and the shippers accepted, or the carriers accepted, that Klausner wouldn't be liable.
Isn't it the case that under Hawkesbury, the court said, only if the carrier has released the shipper from liability under the bills of lading is the shipper discharged from his duty? And so it'd be odd to say in the Hawkesbury, the consignor is liable if he doesn't release in the bill of lading, and he is responsible if he does release in the bill of lading.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And here
he had to be able to protect himself in that bill of lading. Now, let me just ask this. To the extent, what do we do to the extent? Let me say this. It strikes me in looking at the bill of lading that the better reading, for sure, of the prepaid is just a question that the consignee is not to be asked for money again. That looks like that's what that does. And it tells the shipper, don't bug that guy for money when you get there. He's already paid for the shipment. Okay? But what do we do? What do we do in light of the fact that is there an inconsistency between those two? If it's read another way, if it's read the way that could it be read the way that the other side wants to read it? That prepaid is some kind of term of art in the shipping industry that says you've already paid to the consignor.
It could not be read the way that the carriers want it to be read, because that would necessarily render the prepaid clause and the non-recourse clause irrational.
Well, that's what they say. I think that's what they say.
Well, Your Honor, in contract construction, the court is supposed to read all clauses of a contract consistently if there is a plausible reading, and you just gave one.
A shipper that goes to pick up some goods, I'm not exactly sure when the bill of lading is given to the shipper, but what should a shipper do when a shipper sees a bill of lading like this one?
What should the carrier do?
I'm sorry. I mean the trucking company, whoever. What should they do to protect their interest in light of this language that's confusing to them, perhaps?
Well, the Supreme Court gave some suggestions in Illinois Steel that I think would apply. One is they could refuse to deliver the goods until they receive payment. They could keep the trucks closed and not let the furniture go out the back end until their account.
Or at least until they had clarified who was getting, how they were getting their money.
That's right. They could also extract a guarantee of payment from one of the other entities, either the shipper or the broker.
Why? Let me ask you this. Do you have any, this may or may not be in the record. I've puzzled over this. Hundreds of thousands of dollars involved in here. Why would shippers, with that option, with this language, why would they continue just to ship hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of goods?
Well, I think because if you look at the full record, they clearly expected Salem to pay, and they had extended credit to Salem, and there is no record about whether they believe the creditworthiness of Salem. So I can't speculate about that, but it's clear that they expected that Salem was going to pay them. And I think that the extension of credit to Salem is potentially dispositive in answering the question of who they expected to pay.
So either they thought Salem was going to pay under the facts of this case, or they just thought that they would get money from somebody, and perhaps if they didn't haul, somebody else would haul, so they might as well at least have chance for getting paid, maybe?
I mean, it would just be speculating, but I believe that they did think that Salem would pay them, and I think that they, my speculation would believe that it would be that they believed Salem was going to be solvent and able to do that, able to make that payment. I mean,
I just want to go back now to the bill of lading argument. Do you think you can win this case on the merits, if we get to the merits, just on the bill of lading? Because you make an argument about giving a construction that gives meaning to every word. You think you went on just that?
I think.
Do you think you have other information that helps you? I want to hear your full argument on that.
I think that we could win on the merits just based on the bill of lading. But I would say that the court has to divine the intent of the parties and can look to the other circumstances, which I think confirm Klausner's reading of the bill of lading. As the district court pointed out, the only party that testified about the meaning of the bill of lading was Klausner. Its CFO testified that the prepay clause was meant to protect the consignee. The non-recourse clause was to protect Klausner from double payment, the exact thing that the carriers are trying to extract here. The other evidence that I think is most helpful are the separate agreements that the carriers had with Salem, which indicated that the carriers We're billing to Salem, we're using Salem invoice numbers, and we're providing their proof of delivery to Salem, and in fact, we're being paid by Salem. The other thing that I pointed out earlier is that the carriers extended credit to Salem. And there's some cases, like the National Shipping of Saudi Arabia case, I believe, is one where the court has found the extension of credit to actually be a dispositive factor or potentially dispositive factor. That if you extend credit to the freight forwarder or the broker, that that's the party that you can look to for payment. And it's clear under North Carolina law, there was some discussion of this in the briefs, but it's clear under North Carolina law and in other cases involving this area that the court is well within its bounds to look at these other facts and circumstances that surrounded not only the entry into the agreement, but the way that the agreement, in fact, was carried out among the parties. I'm not sure that I don't want to change topics, Your Honor.
You can change topics if you'd like to. I think everybody else in the room might appreciate it if you did.
I wanted to go back just to the subject matter jurisdiction because I'm not sure that we covered all of the potential bases that were articulated, and we didn't have an opportunity to respond to the bases that were articulated in the brief.
You can use your time to do that.
5 minutes.
Okay. The preemption.
You can do it for 5 minutes.
the preemption argument in particular I wanted to point out because the cases that were cited in their brief for the argument that these matters are simply preempted by a provision of the Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act don't actually support the premise that this case would be preempted. If you read the cases that they've cited, they go back to airline deregulation and the American Airlines versus Woolens case that the Supreme Court decided, and the UPS case that they cite deals with this specific statutory framework that we're talking about here, the ICCTA. And it's clear that breach of contract matters are not preempted. There has to be a state regulation of trade for there to be preemption. So, for example, if they had sued Klausner and alleged a violation of North Carolina's Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act because of some type of egregious breach of contract, we would have argued that that is preempted because it is a state regulation. But a breach of contract itself is simply the parties imposing upon themselves certain duties and obligations, and courts have consistently found that, including all the cases that they've cited, have consistently found that there is no preemption. Another case that they cited as a potential basis for going against the number of district courts who have found that federal question jurisdiction doesn't exist is the Old Dominion case. And I do want to point out that is an Eastern District of New York case that relied for its holding on a Supreme Court case that predated deregulation and that depended on jurisdiction, depended on the fact that the tariffs were filed. Well, the Eastern District of New York revisited this same issue in the GMG Transwest case that we cited in 2010 and said that Old Dominion, if a non-filed rate tariff was at issue, was erroneously decided and affirmed that, in fact, there is no federal question jurisdiction.
Could I ask why I find a number of unpublished opinions on point and a variety of district court opinions on point, but I found no circuit authority on point. Is that your experience also?
Yes, Your Honor. I have not found any circuits that have answered this question directly, although there are cases in which circuit courts, in discussing other issues, recognize that there is no federal jurisdiction. There is the case of this goes to the statute of limitations issue, but there's a case of Emmert Industries. It's 497 F3rd 982. It merely mentions that there's no federal jurisdiction and goes on to say that that's not a problem for the application of a federal statute of limitations and says that the federal statute of limitations can be applied to a state court cause of action even in the absence of federal question jurisdiction. So it seems like at least the Ninth Circuit has agreed with this premise, but I believe this precise formulation of the issue is one of first impression for this court.
Thank you.
And just the last point, 14101, I did want to point out that that statute provides it says an exclusive remedy that must be brought in an appropriate state or federal court. But the point of that statute, as multiple cases have decided, like the Transit Homes 2 case in Alabama, is that no longer is the remedy for these contract matters administrative. It's federal. And there is no language that grants jurisdiction in that statute. If you look at the Carmack Amendment, which is section 14706, you can see an example of how in the ICTA jurisdiction is specifically granted, and it says that an action may be brought in a federal district court. It doesn't have the admonition of inappropriate on it. So it simply designates in 14101 that this is now a matter for judicial, not administrative, oversight, and that the words inappropriate simply mean that the court must otherwise have a basis for jurisdiction. So in federal jurisdiction, the example would be diversity. Unless the court has any additional questions, I'd simply say that, again, this is a contract case. The intent of the parties, as discerned by the district court, is that only Salem should be liable. So in the event the court finds it has subject matter jurisdiction, the district court should be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mosley.
Thank you. I would go back to the what's described as the bedrock rule, is that the carrier gets paid. Addressing 14101B, the statute clearly does say that a claim may be filed in an appropriate federal or state court.
But it doesn't say when it's appropriate. And there are instances where it is appropriate because a tariff has to be filed.
And I would say to that that Congress didn't exactly write clearly when...
What a shock.
when they did away with the distinction between common and contract carriage and created just one motor carrier. And so we have this Part 135.
Then the courts have got in the middle of it and made it much more clear, correct?
That's right. And so what we have is we have the Thurston Motor Lines case, which was the United States Supreme Court saying it is. And then we haven't had Congress say it isn't. And so obviously you guys are in the position of being the First Circuit Court to address it, and we'll have to cross that bridge for us. Judge Shedd, you mentioned we were talking earlier about specific documents that might have a play on this, and certainly we believe the Bill of Lading is the operative document. The letter that I referred to is in the record at 424, the one that has care of.
Is it your argument that we look to documents beyond the Bill of Lading?
I don't believe so. I believe you look
then
at the Bill of Lading.
Why do you talk about that letter?
Well, because that's where the magistrate went. And the magistrate
went...
But
I'm asking where you think we should go.
I don't think...
You think it rises and falls solely on the Bill of Lading?
I do. And I think that the magistrate committed error when he got into the subjective opinions of what the parties thought standard industry terms meant. And so, for example, prepaid doesn't mean who's not going to pay. Prepaid means who is going to pay, and prepaid means the shipper pays. While it does have the correlative effect of
but then what do you, if under your analysis, what do you make of that non-recourse language?
Well, and that's a great point.
Well, I'm asking, what do you say? Does it just disappear?
It doesn't disappear now, but it's inconsistent. And so...
Sorry, if it's inconsistent, then what do you do? Don't you look to what the parties meant by that document?
Well, you look at...
Why is it inconsistent? Why are you conceding that?
Because I think that the document is inconsistent in that you can't have prepaid and the non-recourse.
Well, you could have... Why couldn't you have prepaid by Klausner and non-recourse by the consignee?
Because then you'd mark third party if it was going to be Salem being responsible for the freight charge.
Right, but why couldn't the non-recourse apply to the consignee's rights to come back against the consignor?
And if you look at the history of how the Bill of Lading was used, in 1994, it was used, and they had the non-recourse in there when they were paying the freight charges. And so clearly it doesn't mean what the, clearly Klossner.
What is your position that it means?
Well, Klossner didn't know what it means. And I don't think that it has any effect in this because it's inconsistent with prepaid. And prepaid is the way that the parties treated the relationship before Salem was involved and after Salem.
So your argument is that the non-recourse language typed out and signed there, it means nothing.
Well, you'd have to do the same thing that Illinois Steel and Jones Motor Lines did in trying to resolve it.
But I'm asking how you resolve it. It has prepaid, and it also has what appears to be attempt to establish non-recourse against the consignor. You would just say that language about non-recourse just goes away?
Well, I think that what you do with that is you say that you can't have additional charges such as accessorial charges, things of that nature that were not envisioned at the beginning. So let's say that there was a load that had to be...
No. So you mean it applies to additional charges that aren't at the point contemplated?
Additional in the sense of like there's no loading dock at the destination, and so they have to have a lift gate or some other service be provided at the destination. Well, that was not something that Klossner would have envisioned when they began this shipment. So that would be the kind of thing I would think it would apply to.
I'll give you 5 seconds to wrap up if you'd like, Mr. Mosley.
Well, Your Honor, thank you for hearing me, and it's a pleasure being before you.
All right, thank you very much. We will have the clerk adjourn the court, then we'll step down and greet counsel.
This honorable court stands adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9:30. God save the United States and this honorable court.